In June of 2004, I read an article where the writer had asked Warren Buffett what books he had enjoyed the most from his reading in 2003. On that short list was Maggie Maher's book, Bull, A History of the Boom from 1982 through 1999. Well, the book is the best resource I have found in giving us an overview of the most powerful bull market ever in U.S. history. It unfolds like a play with three acts and many characters. If today you have this belief that no one can know the future of the markets, and that there are no flashing road signs along the way to point out the coming top, the book will quickly smash those naive notions. It also will make clear that by avoiding the herd, you would have avoided the pitfalls of buy and hold, or what I today might call buy and fold as it pertains to bear markets. But even those who were the Greek chorus along the way in the late 1990s found that they were not always welcome, but were chastised by the experts and the masses. I will read to you a few comments by members of the Greek chorus to illustrate how hard it is to swim against the crowd. The first comment will be by William Powers, a media critic. The buy focus spilled over into the general media, the big newspapers and networks. They almost never spoke of selling, and we almost never asked. It was rude to bring it up, like walking into a wild party and talking about death. Each reporter is assigned a particular industry, and like the cop with the beat, he gets to know the people in the neighborhood. But the danger is that he begins to feel that he is part of the industry. The PR people and Wall Street analysts who promote that industry become his sources. Over time, some may become his friends. In any case, to gain acceptance to corporate executives, he needs their goodwill. This puts a damper on investigative reporting. The second comment comes from an anonymous manager at a Wall Street brokerage. Our organization and many organizations managed their managers and compensated their managers for being in a certain place in the Morningstar or the Leaper pecking order, rather than on their absolute performance. If you made 15%, but other portfolios in your category were willing to take greater risk and made 20%, you might earn 4 stars that year instead of 5. As a result, your bonus would shrink, even though your investors had made 15%. On the other hand, if you lost 10%, but others in your category lost 20%, you might well pick up a star and get a raise. Your Morningstar rating could determine your entire bonus. Sometimes you made stupid investment decisions buying a stock that was hot, just to raise your short-term rating. And I did this, he added ruefully, even though I had all my own savings in my own fund. In case you think that the comments of the anonymous manager were an isolated incident, consider the following. The Jerome Levy Forecasting Center, a highly respected, nonpartisan, independently funded consulting firm, would expose just how far and how deep the rot had spread in a seminal study of corporate accounting during the bull market called 2 Decades of Overstated Corporate Earnings. Over the past 10 years, the financial media had spotlighted case after case misrepresentation, but the focus of the public concern remained on finding the bad apples. Little attention was paid to the quality of the entire bushel, the study's authors wrote. But an academic study of accounting practices does not reveal to us the same perspective of looking at the play from an individual life. For that, we go next to Gail Dudak, who today is the chief investment strategist for SunGard Institutional Brokerage Services. At the time, she was one of the brokerage. But an investigative study of accounting practices does not give us the individual perspective of the drama. For that, we go next to Gail Dudak, who today is the chief investment strategist for SunGard Institutional Brokerage Services. In the late 90s, she was a frequent guest of the Louis Rukeyser show. Still, she wasn't quite prepared for Louis Rukeyser to fire the first shot. The morning of Saturday, November the 6th, 1999, Dudak was making breakfast for her 9-year-old son when the phone rang at her Westchester home. First, the call came from the neighbor down the street. "Gail, why did they do this to you? What happened?" Dudak had no idea what her neighbor was talking about. She did not know that the night before she had been humiliated on national TV in front of millions of viewers who watched the PBS hit Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser. So what were his comments? "Tonight," he announced, "we will be making one of our period checks on who the winners and sinners are among market forecasting elves." He paused just a second for dramatic effect. "And based on the checkup, we're going to make one substitution tonight. One of the elves was about to be banished." So why had Rukeyser removed her from the show? The next paragraph explains. Rukeyser proceeded to excoriate the one elf and one elf only who had been stuck in the same position for the past 156 weeks running. Dudak, the show's sole bear, had been cautious since the fall of 1997. Dudak had recognized that for much of 1998 and 1999, her short-term forecast had been wrong, but she had not been particularly perturbed. Valuations make no sense. This quarter, next quarter, the quarter after that, no one knows when, but the market will plunge. It is interesting irony that Rukeyser replaced a Dudak with Alan Bond. The following is a comment of Mr. Bond shortly after joining Rukeyser's show. A month after Rukeyser tapped Bond to fill Dudak's spot, Alan Bond was indicted by the Manhattan DA, charged with taking more than $6 million in kickbacks. No drama of the times would be complete without one member of the cast reflecting the Internet. That member is Henry Blodgett, who was Merrill Lynch's chief investment analyst at the time. Yet professional fund managers could not afford to ignore the Internet, as Blodgett told Forbes in 2000. It's important to remember that stocks like Yahoo and AOL recently added to the S&P, the benchmark for a lot of professional managers. And these stocks have the potential to go up 100% to 200% in a given period. AOL was up 300% 2 years ago, 100% last year, and Yahoo had pretty much the same performance. You have extraordinary risk if you do not buy them and are benchmark to the S&P 500. The risk Blodgett was talking about was not investment risk, but career risk. And he was right. For most of his institutional clients, this was the major concern. Our final member of the cast was a value manager who had been around for years in the money game. His name, Jean-Marie Evillard. "All things are cyclical," he said, accepting the inevitable. "This means that by definition, all value managers are market timers. We refuse to participate in the last few years of a long bull market because those last few years are when you get a speculative bubble." In 1996, however, many of Evillard's investors were displeased and they began to take their money elsewhere. From the spring of 1995 to the spring of 2000, that was our crossing of the desert, Evillard later recalled. By 2000, more than half of his clients had jumped ship, even though the portfolio managed to return 8.5% in 1997 and 19.6% in 1999, with just one losing year, 1998, when it lost 0.3%. Evillard began to feel isolated. "It is warmer inside the herd. It is terribly lonely to be a value investor," he noted in 1996. However, the story wasn't completed in the 90s. In 2002, after reviewing the performance of some 372 diversified foreign stock portfolios, Morningstar named Jean-Marie Evillard, along with co-manager Charles Duvall, the International Manager of the Year. If you are wondering what this can tell us about today's markets, I can only say that you need to continue to read the comments of those like Richard Russell, Gail Dudek, James Chanos, Warren Buffett, Bill Gross, and the others who saw the top coming and changed direction. I find it very interesting that in July of 2004, their voices still are drastically different from Washington and Wall Street. From Washington